Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. This podcast is all about the future, all about emerging technologies, all about positive change, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Man, I'm excellent. Feeling so much better than I did last week, and so, yeah.
You are sounding better.
I feel better.
I think writing that post about how healthcare should work helped you expunge the virus faster.
Well, it made me feel better, that's for sure. what it was about for the audience is that, I just am completely dissatisfied with the state of the art in 2007 of fighting viral, colds. And, there's not much to do that except for go home and let it run its course. And looking forward to the day when there is something more that can be done.
Well, what I like about that piece is it speaks to the fact that, the worst part anymore about having a cold isn't so much all the symptoms, which are annoying, which can slow you down and hold back your day. But the worst part is it's so annoying and it feels so pointless. And
yeah.
It seems like really we ought to be able to do something about this. It's the old, if we can put a man on the moon.
That's right. Then what in the world are we still doing messing around with something so basic? But it turns out the common cold isn't all that basic because it's not really one thing. They give you those kind of symptoms. It's all these different viruses that affect you in similar ways. And
they are those small, very sophisticated little enemies that we're dealing with there, really. So,
yeah.
Quite an army of them, too. So,
well, I hope you had a good Thanksgiving, Phil.
Very nice, very nice. Had the whole family in town, and we ate just tons and tons of food. Finally packed them all out of here a little bit earlier this afternoon, and, starting the long road to recovery. But how about yourself?
Oh, it was great. I got well fast enough to really enjoy the holiday and got out there. And I do what I do every year, which is smoke the turkey. We don't put it in the oven. I don't like that. It's dried out, in my opinion, when you bake a turkey. And so I put it in the smoker. And if you ever have it that way, you won't be satisfied with it any other way.
I'm a big fan of smoked turkey. We also like fried turkey,
which is also good. Yeah,
also from Louisiana. So
yeah,
you guys know from how to make turkey down there.
Yeah, well, I tell you, the further south you go in this state, the more people know about food. Louisiana has some good food, no doubt about that. Unfortunately, we did not do well this week in football, though.
Well, see, now, I wasn't going to bring it up if you didn't. But
well, I kind of need to, since we've been following LSU so closely for about a couple months now.
Yeah, we have ever since very near the beginning of the season. So LSU versus Arkansas. Actually, I wasn't watching it. I was watching the Colorado-Nebraska game at the time, which was a much more satisfying game. But they kept showing the scores, and it sounds like that was except for the ending, very exciting game.
Well, it was. There is an offensive player, Darren McFadden, on the Arkansas team, who's he's a Heisman Trophy contender, and just an excellent player. And it really was the offense. It was Arkansas's offense, their ability to overcome what had been the best defense in college ball. They overcame it and they made incredible yardage on LSU. Now, obviously, the score was, they got 50 points, LSU got 48. And so it was like, what, two or three overtimes? I lost count.
I believe it was the third overtime when what finally happened was the Arkansas got a two-point conversion on the touchdown. LSU still managed to come back, score a touchdown, but then failed to get the two-point conversion, which, according to the announcers for the Colorado game, is exactly how they lost to Kentucky earlier.
Yeah, and also in the third overtime. Those overtimes have been kind of brutal on LSU this year. Now this loss basically puts them out of the. I think that it would be just about impossible for them to finish the season number one, which is a shame. They really thought that they could do it this year, and they've done it in the past. But they certainly were in the running for this year, but it doesn't appear that that's going to be the case. Now I believe that they will go to a bowl game. And so, yeah, they've had a great season, and LSU has a lot to be proud of. But they got to get themselves back together to play again this week, and then they get a break, I believe. So,
oh, okay. But the national championship looks like that's now out of the picture for them.
Yeah, it appears to be the case that's out of the picture. So,
I just want to point out, before I talk a little bit about Colorado sports very briefly, and then we move on to the future and some of that stuff that the show's related to, we're having kind of an interesting chat here in our Fast Forward Radio chat room about what things are good and bad for you.
I wouldn't think of Thanksgiving meals necessarily being a great thing for you.
Well, it's what's interesting was the first comment was, I thought smoked is bad for you. And I have to say, I don't think fried is all that great for you either. And actually, you're right. Probably even a roasted turkey, once you start laying on the mashed potatoes and the gravy and the stuffing and all that stuff. It's all about moderation, I'm thinking.
Well, if there's one day of the year that moderation ought to be placed to the side, it's Thanksgiving. I mean, we all have a right to have one feast a year, right?
That's right.
And so, it was funny. I promised myself I wouldn't, go back no seconds this year, and so there were. And my family was laughing at me. My plate looked like, it was.
Since you're not going for seconds,
I'm not going for seconds. But the first, I'm going to make the first helping count, and so it was not just that it was that my plate was piled wide on the plate. It was also piled high. So
there you go.
Yeah,
very good.
It was fun. And the company was great and everything, and so. But yeah, have you ever noticed that after Thanksgiving meal, it's hard to sit through the ball game?
I mean, hopefully you're in a comfy chair and you can just kind of snooze.
Yeah, which I did, and I think everybody does. I think it's the turkey that does that.
The turkey, yeah, that's that tryptophan, I believe, is the chemical in the turkey that causes you to sleep. I was just going to say, yeah, one feast a year, but over this past 4 days, I think I managed about five. is the whole problem with that model. Anyway, just real quickly, not to brag or anything, but Colorado did win their game. So not that they're going to, had any shot at being national champions, but they will get to go to a bowl game now, so that's kind of cool. And they beat arch rival Nebraska, which that was nice to see. Denver Broncos, they hadn't played their game when we spoke last week, and then on Monday night they won, and then today they lost. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
Let's talk. If we're going to mention it, let's mention the win on Monday night, right?
That's right. That was exciting. That was a great game. Actually, it was a real exciting game today for Chicago fans, but not so great for Denver fans. But
well, you had something interesting. Another interesting thing happened this week. You got a chance to visit with Dave Goble, and. Tell us, let's set this up a little bit. Tell us who he is.
Well, Dave is the co-founder of the Methuselah Foundation, which runs the Methuselah Mouse Prize. This is the, like the X Prize, it's a push prize, which is intended to reward researchers who can produce a very long-lived mouse. If we can achieve longevity in mice, if we can find a way to make mice live indefinitely, that's going to open up techniques that would eventually be applied to people. So, Dave is the co-founder of that group. We interviewed Aubrey de Grey on this show. What's been about a year and a half ago, I would say.
That's about right. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And at the time, the plan was that the two of us would actually be talking with both Aubrey and Dave. And unfortunately, due to some scheduling trouble, we weren't able to get Dave on the phone. at the same time that we spoke to Aubrey. So we have been trying to arrange an interview with Dave ever since and finally managed to pull that off this week. I don't know what to say about the interview other than it's just great fun talking to him. He has tremendous insights, tremendous perspectives, and I think everyone will enjoy listening to what he has to say.
Well, let's listen then.
Okay. We are pleased to welcome to the program David Goebel. David is the Chief Executive Officer of the Methuselah Foundation, which is an organization whose charter is nothing less than to reverse or preempt the damage of aging and the unimaginable suffering that this continues to inflict. Dave Goebel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Phil.
Now, I wanted to start out and talk a little bit about the Methuselah Foundation, and I thought maybe you could give us some background on how that all got started. How did you get the idea for founding this organization, and how did you initially get it going?
Well, as a combination of things is typical. I do a lot of volunteer work, and so does my family. And one of the results of that is that you run into people of a variety of backgrounds and status and situations. One of those was that I began to notice a pattern of some of the older friends and folks that we helped where they were terrific one day, and the next day they had Parkinson's or got a stroke or fell backwards down the stairs because their grip strength wasn't enough to hold on to the handrail and died or got, pretty nasty stuff. And I started connecting the dots and thought to myself, this is kind of ridiculous. Most people think of old people as, you've served your purpose, you've done your duty, it's time for you to get out of the way, which feels very evil to me. But up until this era, there wasn't much that could be done about it, so people sublimated those feelings that it was horrible and decided that since it was natural, it was okay, like granola. So,
but at least granola tastes good sometimes, right? Put enough brown sugar in it.
Sure. But, just because it's natural doesn't mean it's good. So, aging is more like living on the side of an active volcano. It's going to get you.
I remember a few years back, the former governor of Colorado, Dick Lamb, gave an address to some seniors in which he actually used the phrase, duty to die. We have a duty to die, to get out of the way and make room for the next generation coming along. And that's always struck me as just, one, an unbelievably callous thing to say, but two, something that, could you ever conceivably say that unless you were just sort of giving in to what you perceive to be the inevitable?
Right.
I mean, you wouldn't say that to a healthy young person, that they have a duty to die.
Yeah, that wouldn't make sense. But so we tend to classify people as a way of making our lives simpler. Simpler doesn't help sometimes. Simpler doesn't get us to the right answer sometimes. So one day.
So you're struck by this problem, and where does that lead you?
Well, I wanted to end it, and started looking at why it hadn't been ended. But part of it was, why aren't there any cures? If you think about medical history, most of the cures have come about from special circumstances. There's a difference between cures and treatments. You can go to any drugstore today, go to over-the-counter stuff, and get treatments that will never cure the problem. We still get colds. We still have asthma. We still have diabetes.
Right.
And you think about cures, many, if not most of them, came about because of military necessity. In order to build the Panama Canal, you got to get rid of yellow fever. So you cure it. You have incredible expenditure from veterans who are wounded, and so you develop incredibly good surgical techniques from battlefield wounds, and so on and so forth. So you ask in the civilian world what was the last thing that was cured, and the answer would be polio.
I was just about to say polio. Now, was there a military need driving that, or is that, no, you just listed that as one on the civilian side.
That's right. And so I began to look at that one historically to say, well, how come that one is different? And the answer is it was an excruciatingly special circumstance that sort of proves the thesis.
And is this going to be FDR? Is this the reason that polio?
Well, it was more than just FDR.
Okay.
First, we're very used to charities today, like the American Cancer Society and this foundation and that foundation.
Right.
But in those days, the idea of a charity was fairly new and novel, and the law, not so much the law, but the medical research community was in an infant stage. So you had this thing called the March of Dimes, which was literally about dimes, because it was going on during the Depression. And you had a three-time president who happened to have polio, and you had somebody running the March of Dimes who is almost unknown to the world, but you could say that he was as much as anybody responsible for the cure.
That's, what's interesting about that is I associate President Roosevelt with the March of Dimes. And in my head, anyway, I thought that he was the founder and the driving force behind the March of Dimes. And now I'm about to learn different. Is that right?
That's right. The man's name was Basil O'Connor.
Basil O'Connor.
He was a New York lawyer, personal friend of Roosevelt. And for decades, he headed the March of Dimes for free as its president, and made very, very difficult decisions, which resulted in faster progress than would have been expected, and a sole focus on a cure. Well, another thing was that this was a disease that wasn't attacking a particular demographic. It cut across all demographics. Rich, highly educated, dirt poor, they all had the same risk to their children.
Right.
So our biology and our sympathy goes heavily and deeply toward children. And finally, another component of this was the excruciatingly high lifetime cost of those who didn't die, living in iron lungs, and the pitiful state of watching your children be in these iron lungs, and the terror that it might strike. So all of those things conspired, you might say, to solve the problem. So you may recall at the end there was a real dust-up between the live and dead virus camps, between Salk and Sabin. Sabin making the statement or have the opinion that Salk's vaccine was going to kill people.
Wow.
Because it was a live virus. And Sabin's backers making the appeal to O'Connor and the March of Dimes to actually cut off Salk's funding, that it was a criminal thing to keep funding him. Anyway, it turned out that Salk's vaccine worked.
Right.
And that it was 2 years, I think, earlier than Sabin's vaccine, and thus protected 2 years worth of people who would have been with no protection. And I happened to be part of that that world. At that time, I was a youngster.
Right.
I got a vaccine. And so...
You got one of the Salk vaccines, or do you know which one you got?
I think it was the Salk. I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I remembered that as part of my thinking about how can we drive toward cures. And I realized that there was just a confluence of a number of very special circumstances that might happen once every 1,000 years. And that wasn't good enough.
Right.
So that's when I began looking for a model. So keep in mind that what I'm really trying to do is to prevent diseases. Why that? What's that got to do with aging? Because diseases, diseases are the falling off the cliff phenomenon. If you keep walking toward the cliff and walking toward the cliff, well, doggone it, you're going to fall over the cliff sooner or later.
Right.
And that falling over the cliff is the disease that you get.
Well, the relationship between those two things becomes very clear if you read Aubrey de Grey's book, Fighting Aging. It seems to me that once you start to recognize that all these different kinds of accumulation of damage that occur, that Aubrey has classified, that really constitute and define what aging is, ultimately they all result in or make you vulnerable to one disease or another. So when you listed those diseases earlier, you said, we haven't cured diabetes. And you think, well, and we've never really eliminated Alzheimer's. We can't cure Alzheimer's. We haven't eliminated heart disease, all these things that kill us. If you, is it fair to say, let me pose it this way, if you find an effective way to deal with aging, a lot of these things are going to come along for the ride.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The way I think of it is no one in their right mind would live in a toxic waste dump. As soon as that's found, the Superfund attacks it, and people are moved, and you couldn't sell that land on a bet. And so then think of your own body as a toxic waste dump. After a while, that's what it becomes.
Right.
And so we need to have a Superfund to clean it up.
Okay, so enter the Methuselah Foundation and the M-Prize. So how did you get it started and what's the current status
okay.
of this?
Well, first I had to figure out what modality to use. So remember, I was looking for cures, and I wanted to find the reason why the cures weren't happening. And
okay.
The quick answer to the reason the cures weren't happening was because the time to develop a pharmaceutical intervention and the money is somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 years and $500 million. So imagine this. A scientist comes into your office, you're the finance committee, and the scientist says, I think I figured out a way where one pill with a cost of a dollar could cure cancer.
Wow.
If you walked into that into the committee, or actually a better example would be diabetes.
Okay.
You go in front of the pharmaceutical board, and this corporation is making $3 billion a year on insulin and related products. You come in and say you're going to cure it. What's that group going to do? They're going to say, well, let's see. We're going to spend $500 million. It's going to take 15 years. And
it's going to run us out of business.
If it works, it's going to run us out of business. And it probably won't work.
Right.
And who knows what's going to happen over 15 years. That's an eternity in the investment world. So they'll pat the guy on the back, thank him very much, and ask for the next proposal. These are not bad people. These are people making rational decisions because their first allegiance by law must be fiduciary responsibility.
They've got to make money for the shareholders.
That's
right?
Exactly right.
Okay.
That's their first allegiance, and they'll be sued and go to jail if they don't follow that. So, anyway, that's what led to prizes. I read Davis Sobel's novel Longitude about the Longitude Prize, and it just seemed to me that it was the straightest line between the two points. And that's where the idea of using prizes came from.
So if money is going to drive everything anyway, get the money rewarding the correct behavior.
That's exactly right. So a prize is like the moon. It just sits there, it shines down, and says, come and get me. It has no politics, it can't be gamed, it can't be argued with. It can't be beguiled. Look at me, I'm a PhD, or I'm a beautiful woman. The moon just doesn't care.
Right.
It's, can you get here? Soul, rationale, a sole criteria. And so in this case, that led to the M Prize to reverse aging in model experimental mice.
And what is the current status of the prize? How much is it, and who will it be awarded to, or has some been awarded to date, or just kind of where are we with the prize?
Okay, so the prize amount is just north of $4.5 million.
Wow, that's a good chunk of money.
Thank you. Other prizes, well, thank our donors. Other prizes are announced with a target number. We haven't announced the target number. We just want to keep having it grow and grow and grow, because it increases the attractiveness, obviously, and thereby the number of participants. Right now we have about 10 teams that are pursuing the prize, and we would like gradually for every university in the world to begin to get involved. That's part of the value of the prize idea, because it's somewhere between 16 and 50 to 1 leverage for every dollar in a well-posed prize generates $16 to $50 in other people's investment into solving the problem.
Plus, that's an amazing ratio, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's just remarkable.
That's some tremendous leverage you're getting. Round it down to $4 million, that's saying that anywhere from... what'd you say?
65,
it would be upwards of $40 million being
anywhere from $65 million to $250 million effective weight, and it operates under a power curve, so that the higher the amount of the prize, the even more the leveraged ratio, until you get to prizes like going to the moon, which is a political prize, or being first to have the atomic bomb, another political prize.
Right.
In this case, it's not money that is the award, but it's survival.
Right.
Whether it be in a cold or a hot war. But you think about how long would it have taken to have gotten an atomic bomb without a war to drive it. Not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying, think about the amount of time.
Yeah. What would the motivation have been? There would have been nothing driving that happen.
But so an even more interesting example of this, the effectiveness of prizes, is something that history has forgotten. But because I was intent on learning everything I could, I dug it up, and that was Napoleon had a pretty nasty experience in Russia, and he learned the value of having food to feed an army.
Right.
It's not bullets that make an army work in those days, it's food.
Right.
So the Russians were pretty clever about that. First, they arranged for winter, and second, they burned all the food along the way. So when he got back, Napoleon issued a requirement to the French Academy of Sciences to have a prize for food preservation in the field, food that would survive at least 6 months so that they could feed an army. Well, after a little while, a French chef named Nicolas Appert, A-P-P-E-R-T for you Wikipedia fans, discovered after lots of trial and error that if you put food in a bottle, took all the air out of it, boiled the stink out of it, and then put a wax cork in the stopper in the top, that the stuff would be okay.
So invented the canning process that...
Bottling and canning.
Everybody's mom and grandma uses.
That's right. Thank you
for
the summary. Now, that is the most important invention in history. Pretty bald statement.
I was just going to say, wait, what about the iPod?
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I lost my mind.
Yeah. So, okay, that is a bold statement. So why is, I can certainly see that it's a huge impact, but why is preserving food the most important invention in history?
Okay. Famine, wherever there is preserved food, famine ceases to exist.
Okay.
where famine ceases to exist, populations grow and lifespans grow. When populations grow and lifespans grow, knowledge opportunity grows. When knowledge opportunity grows and the number of people who have knowledge grows, then you get a massively parallel processing biological computer. So,
So what Napoleon wanted as a means of feeding an army, you're now saying is what has made it possible to feed kind of the whole human army of
thinkers and doers.
Yeah, okay.
So so he invented this, I think it was like the early 1800s, but by 1812, I believe it is, Canning came into the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then with that, since 1840, if you look at the typical uptake time for, or proliferation time for a radical new technology, it usually takes about 20 years, 15 to 20 years in our era. Like when the laser phenomenon was discovered, it took 20 years for that technology to find its way into actual products.
Right.
So since this was so long ago, in the early 1800s, we'll say that it took a little bit longer, maybe 30 years. Well, by 1840, the lifespan of the most advanced country, Sweden at the time probably, from 1840 to today, every year for 160 plus years, the human lifespan has been increasing a quarter year or 3 months a year, every year.
And this is since the introduction of
That's
canning.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
Since the introduction of canning. And how much did it cost? 20,000 francs.
Wow.
So you take a look at all human history prior to that time, and famine was just an accepted cost of doing business.
Right.
And then one day someone says, hey, let's fix it. But why? For military reasons. It's insane. But if you ask yourself which human being in history is most responsible for the saving of human lives after Jesus Christ, it would have been Napoleon.
Not somebody I would have guessed off the top of my head, I have to say.
Yeah.
That's astounding. So let's bring this back to the subject of aging.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're looking to do is with the Emprise replicate that level of impact.
That's right.
In fact, we're going to have something even bigger than canning, I would think.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's the next step from canning.
Okay.
So canning led to people living longer, having more opportunity to get longer educations and longer careers so that they could have more and more impact. And so that's why you keep getting this longevity dividend that we tend to think of as a medical or a sanitation dividend. what this prize is designed to do is to take that 0.25 per year and increase it above 0.25 to eventually 1.0 or higher, which means that for every year you live, your chances of living the next year are at least as good as your chances of living this year.
This is what Ray Kurzweil describes as escape velocity.
That's something that I came up with.
Oh, okay. This is a term that Rick Kurzweil stole from you called escape velocity.
the first use of that term, not the idea, but the term that I know of is when I send an email out to Peter Diamandis, the founder of the XPRIZE.
Mm-hmm.
When I was saying that we should have lifespan reach escape velocity. And then Aubrey picked up the terminology and called it actuarial escape velocity.
So that's obviously, and Ray didn't steal anything. But
I know.
That's where I first encountered the term in his book. So
yeah,
it's a terrific idea. But the idea is a compelling picture of every year you add a year of lifespan to your life. If you can keep that going, there's no expiration date.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so So the first value of a prize is that it changes the taboos. So when we started the prize, the idea of reversing human aging or living very, very long lives was like Ponce de Leon, Fountain of Youth kind of stuff, just something to laugh at.
Right.
Or something to prevent, like you mentioned before, the fellow who says people have a duty to die.
Yeah, I mean, there are those who would make the case, and still do make the case, that you're actually working against the social good by trying to extend human life.
Right.
I'm sure you encounter that attitude all the time.
So the interesting thing is we encountered that all the time when we started.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about a prize, if you think about racing, almost all of car racing is against the law, except for the fact that there's an event that we call a race.
Okay. All right.
Right? You go and take your car in downtown L.A. and go 200 miles an hour and see how long you last.
Right.
However, if you organize it into a race, all of a sudden, instead of people wanting you to put you in the slammer, they're cheering you on to go even faster.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Aha. It's crazy, isn't it?
That is crazy.
That's the value of a prize. It takes what is socially unacceptable for whatever reasons and then turns it into a positive good where the public actually cheers you on.
So if you're just a guy saying, hey, we got to do something about aging, then you've got the buzzkill saying you're a nut job and you're gonna hurt the world. But if you put the M-Prize in place, and it's a big, it's a nonprofit, and it's clearly doing work, and there's a goal that researchers start working towards. That actually, is it fair to say, actually changes the public discourse around this subject?
It absolutely does.
Okay.
You can think of it as an umbrella. The naysaying, the nabobs of negativity are like the dark, drizzling rain. And the prize is an umbrella under which those who would like to be audacious can go. And they can point to the prize and say, well, gee, I'm just doing it, you know, for the glory and the good and the money. And they can then get investors because there's some money at the end of the rainbow.
Right.
They can get glory. And most importantly, they can keep their careers. If you do it by yourself, you are really sticking out. But if there's 10 teams going after the same thing, well, then your social pariah status goes way, way down, and in fact, you become a hero of science. And that is actually what we've seen. I'm astounded at how quickly the conversation has turned from you can't do it, to you mustn't do it, to you shouldn't do it, to it can be done, but we shouldn't do it, to it will be done, and, well, since it will be done, we might as well do it. So now the conversation is, should we let it happen naturally, or should we aggressively pursue the reversal of the damage of aging? So this is, you know, you can think of, it's astounding how quickly that's changed.
And we're well on our way, would it be fair to say, to we must do it. We must do it as soon as possible.
We are well on our way there. And why are we well on our way there? Because we have 72 million extremely rich, richer than any generation in history, baby boomers.
Right.
And who have been watching TV shows that talk about turning back age by using radical surgery, plastic surgery. And that is a huge growth business. Plus you have the most dangerous generation in history financially, and that would be the baby boomers again,
okay,
who are going to bankrupt nations. Well, there's two ways of dealing with that. One is to reduce benefits, which no politician wants to do that.
Well, you're not going to get elected on that platform, are you?
Have de facto euthanasia.
That doesn't sound very good.
Well, it's not everybody's favorite solution. Or another option, which is now viable, is to pursue the removal of the frailty of aging.
And so we save the economy by keeping the boomers alive, keeping them productive.
Keeping them healthy and productive. Taxpayers.
That's an amazing argument. And the boomers, of course, are on board with this because they're hitting 60 now, and they've been young for 60 years, and suddenly, you know, it's dawning on them that they're not young.
Right.
That there really is something to this whole you get older thing. I mean, they're actually feeling it in their bodies and seeing it when they look in the mirror, and they want to do something about it.
Right. And there's this there is a the rate of discovery and engineering capability is continuing to go up exponentially. So, for instance, you now instead of computer chips, you now have biological chips that can decode an individual's genome, the important known genes, for $1,000 today. That means that you, Phil, for $1,000, could find out the 50 to 500,000 genes that are currently researched in your body and understand what your probabilities, possibilities in the future are as far as disease, and can take steps today to do something about it.
In fact, if I could do one moment of shameless self-promotion, we just mentioned that capability and two companies that are providing that service in the most recent Better All the Time blog feature on Speculist. So,
And there are going to be many other companies who will do the same or similar things. So think of an individual's body as the last undiscovered country, the undiscovered land.
Right.
You, Phil, are a combination of 100 trillion body cells and 100 trillion bacterial entities who help you digest your food and do other things. So you're a colony organism of 200 trillion components. There are 200 trillion, galaxies out there.
Right, okay.
So my point of view on all of this may be a little Star Trekian, but we are pocket universes.
Wow.
So as a pocket universe, I'm totally unexplored. This isn't an ego thing, it's just a fact.
Right.
Now, how would you like to be in a pocket universe traveling at 200 miles an hour down the road with no headlights and it's totally dark? Think you might hit something?
It seems likely.
So,
unless it's a really empty pocket universe.
Right. So the only time anybody knows anything about these universes called human beings is when they get sick. That's a terrible time to try to learn about something. It's like the psychiatrist. Every time you meet a psychiatrist, you don't know if you want to be his friend because he's constantly trying to find out what's wrong with you, even when you feel fine. Why?
Right.
Because that's what their training is, what's wrong.
So understanding the human genome, understanding our individual genomes is the equivalent of being able to turn the headlights on driving down the pocket universe.
Right. And once those headlights are on, we're going to go, oh, my God, we are utterly, totally, thoroughly ignorant.
Right.
And you ask yourself, Phil, if you were to take a look at your lifelong medical record,
right,
how much information would there be? None. Virtually none.
Very little.
And so, if you know, the doctor does not have access to what happened to little Phil between the ages of 5 and 10? What was his basal blood pressure, heart rate, glucose, epigenetic gene expression? He has nothing to go on. And as a society, we have almost nothing to go on. Imagine if you could have your medical history, mine, and millions of other medical histories that would be anonymized and then mined, you would find incredible insights that are simply unavailable, unfindable today.
Right. So with about 7 minutes left in the show, let's bring this back to the M-Prize and what progress is being made currently with that.
Right. So we had two prize winners. One is Dr. Andre Bartke. He had the mouse that's the world record holder for longevity. There are in the particular mouse strain that we're examining, Mus musculus. There are lots of other mice that may live longer in the wild, but you need to have a class of mouse that is comparable so that you can have teams compete.
Right. See, you can say lived longest comparable, as compared to other members of the same group.
That's right. So there's another class of mouse called the bat, and they live 20 years.
Right.
So we had to find a single class. So his mouse lived just shy of 5 years,
and
which in human terms is somewhere above 150 years.
Okay.
Of course, you can't make a direct comparison, you know, but it's still indicative. A typical mouse would have its maximum longevity end at 3 years. So it was a real outlier.
Right. This is the longest-lived mouse of that class ever.
That is scientifically documentable.
Right. Okay.
Then with the reversal or the rejuvenation prize, the first winner was Dr. Steven Spindler. He took a group of experimental mice, not a one-off, but an experimentally valid group of mice, and put them on a calorie restriction regime for the first time when they were 19 months old, which would be the equivalent of like 55 in humans.
Okay.
So imagine no interventions, you've been eating whatever you felt like until you're 55. Then at 55, all of a sudden, you go on to a calorie restriction regime. Those mice that went on that regime were able to live 15% longer than the regular group.
So this indicates that calorie restriction is not something that has to be followed from birth or youth.
Yeah.
That it, even at a fairly late stage, it can be introduced with benefits.
That's right.
In mice, anyway.
That's right. And so this reversed the damage of aging and slowed down the laying down of further damage. So that's why he won the inaugural rejuvenation prize, because that was the first experiment that actually proved that you could, at such a late age, introduce benefits to a population of mice.
Now, how much of this becomes translatable to what we can do for human beings? There's discussion around how effective calorie restriction is, how effectively those benefits translate to human beings, and I don't know what techniques were used to make the other mouse live to be five. Was that also calorie restriction, or was that some other?
It was a growth hormone knockout gene that turned the mouse into a dwarf mouse, and some would argue that that is similar to the way that calorie restriction works.
Oh, okay.
So
some of the same mechanisms anyway.
Exactly. So my answer to your question, how much of this is translatable, nobody knows.
Right. Okay.
That's the real answer. That's why you have to use a prize. The best time to use a prize is when you have no idea what exactly to do to solve a problem. If you did, you'd just do that. So nobody in the world had any idea how to preserve food. In fact, they were probably pretty sure it couldn't be done.
Right.
Otherwise, somebody would have done it.
So if
nobody had any idea how to find longitude at sea, but the costs of losing fleet after fleet because you couldn't know that you were about to hit the shoals near shore because you thought you were 60 miles away from the shore. Nobody had any idea how to solve that problem. But they thought they did. The astronomers thought that they knew what to do, but it turns out they had no clue.
So what's the pathway, what's the timeline in your mind between the Methuselah Mouse Prize and, say, the Methuselah Human Prize, right? The next stage where this becomes an effort to actually bring these benefits about for human beings.
Well, I can't go into any great detail on this, but Aubrey has come up with a very, very powerful model for a human prize, and I have my own ideas, but let's just say that we're in active discussion with various parties on a human prize. The real problem with a human prize is you can't hide behind cute mice anymore.
Right. You have to get cute human subjects.
Right. And then you ask yourself, is it ethical to have a placebo group?
Right. Yeah, that's a tricky one for sure.
Right.
Now, you mentioned that there have been two winners. Does that mean that there's no longer $4.5 million in the prize fund, or how does that work? Is there?
So these were inaugural winners. They didn't even know that they were competing.
Okay.
But in order to have a prize, you have to have a valid goal line. And so that's how we were able to set the bar for first winners.
Okay.
So Dr. Barkey helpfully and coincidentally set our bar at just shy of 5 years for the no-holds-barred, one-off, longest Guinness Book of World Records mouse lifespan. Dr. Spindler gave us the goal line for rejuvenation of a little bit more than 3 years. So it's interesting. Most people we encourage people to place their donations where they wish, so they can, for instance, donate to the Longevity M Prize or the Rejuvenation M Prize.
Okay, with less than a minute left, let's talk about how can people support these efforts.
Well, they can go to mprize.org, mprize.org, go and learn about our organization, and there's a donate button. And we have a group of individuals who are pretty staunch supporters. The group is called the 300, after the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae.
Okay.
And this is a group who, while society is trying to figure out whether or not this should be done, they have just said, yes, it should be done. And they donate. The criteria is $1,000 a year for 25 years, i.e. $25,000. So about 25% of those individuals give the $25,000 at the front right away. And then others are, you know, doing $85 a month off credit cards. And we have about 160 individuals in that committed giving group, and they're making a signal difference. If 100,000 people die a day from aging, which, by the way, is the current number, then if we could, by means of the efforts of our donors, reduce that time, the time to the cure, by 1 day, that's 100,000 lives saved. So if you think about the leverage in the prize, it's enormous and can make a huge difference to society and individuals.
Okay, that web address again is mprize.org. And Dave Goble, I want to wish you continued success with your efforts. We hope to have you back on the program again soon, and thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
You're very welcome, Phil. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Phil, he's an interesting guy, isn't he?
Well, he is a fascinating guy, and I should just say, why don't we open up the phone lines now if folks want to comment. This is Fast Forward Radio, and you can dial in at 347-215-8972. We're going to be talking for a while about our interview with Dave Goble. If others want to get in on the conversation, we'll certainly make that possible. So, Stephen, what struck you most about what Dave had to say?
Well, the thing that strikes me about the whole endeavor is that if you accept that that life extension is possible, that it's possible to rejuvenate old people and make them young again, then it doesn't seem to me that there's too many really good arguments against doing it. And it also strikes me that there's not too many other things that are more important than doing that.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? I mean, you know, if you accept that this can be done, then all of a sudden it becomes a tragedy that 100,000 people a day are dying of old age related things.
That's right. There's a huge shift in perception that occurs when you go from thinking that this is just fate and there's nothing, there's no point worrying about it, there's no point gnashing our teeth over it, to thinking, oh, well, maybe we could actually do something about that. Once that little wedge of possibility gets in, suddenly the whole argument shifts, it seems.
That's right. And so, yeah, I mean, it seems to me it's the most basic and best of charities in some ways. It's and some of the most important work, if it can be done. And it seems to me that there's a growing consensus that it's just an engineering problem. You know, when people first started talking about going to the moon, that sounded crazy, like crazy science fiction as well. But you know. It was just a matter of solving some problems, and I think that it comes down to that for a life extension as well. We have these difficult problems, and nobody's saying that these problems that have to be solved to give us life extension are going to be easy. But we have these problems; we believe we have them identified, seven things, and you just address these problems. And so I love the idea of how the prize is. You know, he's showing that the prize is perhaps the best method to get it done.
Well, that's what really struck me, and there's a couple of reasons why it's such an effective method to get it done. One is it somehow, just by virtue of the fact that it springs research activity into action, lends credibility to the whole endeavor, which is, I think, astounding in and of itself. But the bigger... I think just more fundamental reason that these prizes are such a good way to go is because they get the money flowing in the right direction. It sounds like if you got a business, you know, he gave that example of the, you know, the company that makes its money selling insulin.
Yeah.
I mean, there is nothing in it for them for diabetes to be cured as an organization. They don't exist for diabetes to be cured. I mean, the people who work there might think that's a good idea. But the organization can't promote that because there's no money in it for them. But if you,
I think it's important we point out that neither Dave nor you nor I believe that there's a conspiracy.
Oh no, of course not.
Because there's not. It's just that these are normal good people that are working in a system that there's not the incentive is not built in for them to do what we really need for them to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
The incentive is instead for them to continue. For the status quo to exist,
right?
That's where the money that's what the money encourages, is for the status quo to continue to exist. And here, what the money does is it encourages a change to occur. I guess that's the big difference. And I just found that a profound insight. It had never occurred to me before. That and just the whole idea of how much research $4 million worth of prize money gives you. Was
right,
incredible.
And you know, if you just went out and bought lab time with $4 million, you wouldn't get as much research as they're actually getting.
Right, not nearly as much. They're getting 60, he said, to $200 million worth of research for $4 million in prize money. The leverage is incredible.
Oh yeah, the whole prize model is a neat thing, and that's why I've been fascinated about it for a while. You know, with X Prize and everything else. The DARPA Grand Challenge, all these different prizes accomplish some remarkable things because of that leverage.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, the main thing I guess we have to say is that they're actually pushing these particular agendas ahead.
Right.
You know, XPRIZE actually enabled Spaceship One to occur. The DARPA Grand Challenge is actually getting us closer and closer to a robotic, self-guided, self-maintained vehicle.
Right.
But the other thing that they're doing that, you know, we don't necessarily think about is that they're encouraging all this research to occur, that they're making it more mainstream, and that they're just sort of adding these ideas to the normal public discourse that weren't there before. and making the whole idea credible and respectable in the process.
You know, in thinking about these ideas and, you know, getting past the whole far-fetched thing, you know, I got to thinking about the politics of it just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as I did, I kind of laughed as I remembered a quote from one of my favorite movies. The great philosopher Bill Murray in Ghostbusters had a quote.
This will explain it.
Oh, yeah, this will explain it. And so I'm going to let him say it in his own words.
But if I'm right, and we can stop this thing, Lenny, you will have saved the lives of millions of registered voters.
You know, I mean, it comes down to that. You know, I mean, if you can convince politicians that there's a chance, you don't have to convince them that it's absolutely going to happen. All you have to do is convince them there's a chance that they would be the big hero that saved the lives of millions of registered voters.
That's exactly the idea, the meme that we need to get into the heads of people on both sides of the aisle in Congress.
That's right.
And,
and you don't want to be the party that was against it, you know, I mean, and then it happens, you know.
Absolutely.
So we need Republicans and Democrats both to accept the idea that it's a possibility. And then all of a sudden that changes the discourse.
Need to be having those talks with the politicians for sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
A couple of additional notes on the interview. I kept referring to we had only 7 minutes left in the show, a minute left in the show, only because that was pre-recorded on the sister program to Fast Forward Radio, which is Better All the Time, which we run sporadically as a means of capturing these interviews with folks. But that also brings up something that we should have mentioned, which is that we are now a featured podcast on Blog Talk Radio.
That's right. Fast Forward Radio now is a featured podcast, and I think it helps that we have a regular time. People can count on us being here on Sunday nights, and you know, have something interesting to say every Sunday. So that's kind of what may have gotten us here. And I hope we will continue to keep our featured status by having something interesting to say.
Well, I hope so too. I think as long as we keep lining up guests like Dave Gopal, there shouldn't be any risk of not having some interesting stuff to say. In addition to which, I should also mention that we're going over just a little bit tonight. We had originally scheduled we're normally a one-hour show, but since Dave's interview ran a little long, we thought we'd tack a few extra minutes on in case we wanted to talk a little bit about the interview. And I don't know if there were some other topics that we wanted to get into this evening.
Well, I'm just thinking again about Dave's interview. Napoleon is a great benefactor of humanity. Who would have thought, huh? That was great.
That is just a startling an idea. Well, that and just the idea on its own that canning was the great the greatest invention in history. You know, when you think about it, you go, yeah, I can really see the case. But if somebody said, hey, what was the greatest invention in history, that's not the one you would think.
Yeah, I would have, you know, I thought, you know, the last 1,000 years, maybe the printing press, you know, something like that. I would not have jumped to canning. But then when you think about all the people it saved, yeah, I can see, you know, that's a huge deal.
Well, it goes to show you that the obvious answer isn't always the answer. We were having a discussion in the chat while we were talking about this, and in the chat, the Fast Forward Radio chat room, the question came up, what's the biggest killer in the world?
I thought it was malaria.
Yep, malaria is a good guess. People with a very U.S.-centric view are going to think it's heart disease or cancer, because those are the ones that we pay a lot of attention to. If you broaden your perspective on the world a little bit, some people are going to say AIDS. If you know the history of the devastation that malaria has caused over the last few decades, then malaria is a very good guess, but it's not by any stretch of the imagination the number one killer. And it's really surprising when you find out what the number one killer is. I actually had to look it up to confirm, because I thought I had heard this a while back, and I wanted to make sure that it's the case. Number one killer. Any guesses?
Well, if it's not malaria, I guess, and it's not AIDS, I would jump in and say tuberculosis.
It's not. It's okay. Diarrhea.
Okay.
The number one killer in the world between dysentery, other forms of diarrhea, and cholera, that is the disease that kills the most people in the world.
Yeah, you can quickly get in trouble and get dehydrated, I know, but that's surprising.
Yeah, I mean, it's not one you would think of, and it comes about through several different courses, the different ways of it occurring, so there's no big campaign to fight it.
Yeah.
And, of course, it largely happens to very poor people, you know, and it doesn't get a lot of press coverage, and so that's not the thing that we think of as happening. But when you think about it, that very much goes to why canning was such a great invention, because when people are dying of dysentery, it's because of the lack of sanitation. It's because of the lack of basic hygiene and health care, the kind of thing that, that canning was intended to address. And just, I guess, goes to show that there's still plenty of room for improvement in this world in a lot of these areas.
Just in research, you know, after listening to the interview for the first time, I went to Wikipedia and was reading up on the March of Dimes. A little piece of trivia, just for our listeners out there, so they can win at Trivial Pursuit or whatever.
Okay, what do you got for us?
Okay. FDR's association with the March of Dimes is what led primarily to him being put on the dime. And so if anyone ever asks why FDR's picture is on the dime, now you know.
See, I would have framed that by asking someone who is on the dime, because I would not have guessed. I didn't even realize it was President Roosevelt who was on the dime. So it's his image that's on the dime.
Right.
And the reason he's on the dime is because of the March of Dimes, which he played such a crucial role in bringing about.
Because of his own disease, which may or may not have actually been polio. So.
Well, now that's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. What he had was a form of paralysis, but there's no consensus at this point that it actually was polio.
How about that? Interesting. I wonder who was on the dime before Roosevelt.
I don't know.
See, now there. Okay.
There you go. There's a piece of trivia.
Wait, I got another one. I got another trivia one for you.
Okay.
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt, what was her maiden name? It's another case where the obvious thing is hiding in plain sight.
I don't have any idea. Please.
Her maiden name was Roosevelt. She was Teddy Roosevelt's niece and Franklin's fifth cousin. So,
interesting.
How about that, huh?
There you go.
This show is good for so much more than just, you know, the you know, it's geekiness and more.
I mean, we always try to throw in a little extra thing, just to give you reason for listening in.
That's exactly right. And speaking of that, I guess maybe we could talk about what our music is this week.
Okay, let's get to that. We as always, you know, we like to feature independent artists, and there's a reason for that. And one of the big things is, I don't know about you, Phil, but I get sick and tired of the top 40 stuff.
Oh yeah,
I mean,
well, it's like it's designed to make you tired of it.
I don't know. It's just like it's the same junk all the time,
over and over. Yep.
And even when it's a new song, it's the same style, or they're saying the same thing over and over. And when you get into independent music, they don't have the same constraints, and they can talk about all kinds of, you know. The subject matter of what they sing about is wide open. Sometimes it's just weird, you know. I mean, something we could use more of on the radio is weirdness.
I think so. I mean, we do our part for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and so, anyway, the song I picked for tonight is not weird, but it's an upbeat tune. It's not what you hear on top 40s music at all. It's completely different. Andreas Weiss is the name of the singer, and his song is Friday Night, and so we're going to get into that here in just a minute. But anyway, it's been fun visiting with you tonight, Phil. We didn't want to cover any other topics before we logged off tonight.
Well, we had more we could do. I think maybe we'll go ahead and call it a night for this edition, and we'll pick up with the other topics next time.
Oh, that sounds great. Okay.
All right. We'll look forward to listening to, I'm sorry, it was Andre Weiss and Friday Night, and look forward to talking with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.